Hi, I'm Leela Ainge, psychologist researcher and someone who's been thinking a lot lately about what really makes life feel good. Welcome back to Psychologically Speaking, a podcast all about human behaviour, bringing together fascinating research, insights and real life experiences. This season, we're exploring joy, not just a theory of it, but how joy actually moves through our lives and how it shifts us and what it makes us do. Today, I'm delighted to be chatting to Lisa Honeyball, who has an online membership, Interior Design Insiders. Lisa helps interior designers to build businesses that support themselves financially, practically, and creatively without the burnout. She encourages a shift towards a calmer and more sustainable way of doing business, rooted in clarity, collaboration, and joy, which is exactly why she's here today. I've got my big vat of coffee here.
I've got my big vat of tea. Never knowingly seen without a cup of tea. Cheers.
Welcome, Lisa, to Psychologically Speaking. I remember being on weekly calls with you and you'd always have the most beautiful mug in the most beautiful space. I wondered if you could describe what your working arrangement is.
Thank you for saying that. Yes, always a mug in hand. So I have a little studio in the garden. The interior designers that I work with, sort of solo, entrepreneurs, will pretty much work from home. I have worked from an office before, like I rented a space. But most of us tend to find a corner of the house. And I have had, you know, over the years, I've done interior design for sort of 14, 15 years. Over the years, I have, you know, taken over a spare bedroom, taken over the dining room table. But I'm really lucky. We did some work on the house just as we were going into lockdown, actually. This garden office space was finished. And I moved from my rented place to here, which was just the best timing. But yeah, I love it. Not on rainy days so much when I have to sprint across the garden. It's not far from the house, but like just a little nip across the garden in the rain to get in here. But it's lovely to have a place which is full of inspiration, but also that I can leave stuff out.
Yes.
So, you know, that's the biggest issue when you work on your dining room table. If you're spreading out, you know, samples, and I mean, you can see some of the stuff behind me, but fabric samples and tile samples, and if you've got mood boards, clearing them away at the end of the day. Certainly the way that I work is that I like to leave stuff out.
Yeah.
And then come back to it. And I really wasn't able to do that. So yes, I've got a little setup out here. In all honesty, I'm not doing that much interior design anymore. I'm more focused on the consultancy, mentoring, coaching, my membership for interior designers. But I still have all of the stuff because I do the occasional interior design job. And I just love being surrounded by it. It does spark joy for me. Just all the little sort of bits and pieces that come with the job.
I love that so much. And for reference for everyone who's listening, I'm actually sat in my camper van today. My office space does not spark joy for me at all. And you'll love this, Lisa. It had bright purple carpet and yellow walls.
Oh my goodness. That's a tough combination.
It was not great. But the best bit about it was that the purple carpet actually had a square of yellow carpet where there'd been a fitted wardrobe at some point, and they just carpeted around the fitted wardrobe. I'm experimenting with different spaces, especially over the summer holidays. The camper van felt like it'd be a quieter space for me to be, and the room's less echoey as well. I think there's something in there about having stuff around and being able to see it visually as you're working on concepts and ideas. And as a researcher, the type of research I do will often be listening back to transcripts or looking at transcripts on paper and physically going through and highlighting. And there's something quite methodical about that, where having it all spread out and around you is a useful thing to do.
Yeah. And different interior designers do work differently. So, you know, I've supported enough interior designers to know that some people can be very visual and do stuff on screens and don't physically need to touch stuff. And it's the same for clients as well. And actually finding that out quite early on, how their senses work is really important. Like, can they visualize? Do they need to touch and feel stuff? How do they get a sense of a space? Yeah, your purple in your office, just to like quickly go back to that, that's a bold choice. Purple is a really difficult colour to work with, and you don't see it. I mean, it depends on the type of purple. There isn't just one purple. It's a quite a divisive colour. You'll find people either love it or hate it. So it's really interesting that, yeah, you had purple in there.
It's upstairs. It's one of the main bedrooms. It looks out over onto the fields. So it's like, I'm going to have this as the study. It's going to be beautiful. They'd had children previously, so my sense is they just put a really dark carpet in there because children were playing in there.
With the yellow, that's actually, they're actually contrasting colours. So your primary colours, your blue, your yellow and your red, the colour they make together is contrasting to the other one, if that makes sense. So if you've got blue, yellow and red, blue and yellow make green, so green and red are contrasting. So red and blue make purple, so yellow and purple are contrasting. So they've gone for a really high impact, dynamic, contrasting colours tend to be quite stimulating. So that would work actually that would hype the children up.
I should have kept it in there and then I would have like been full of energy all day perhaps.
Or overstimulated, that's the problem.
Maybe. I've definitely appreciated when we moved in, I think every wall had colour on it and wallpaper. And I hadn't realised about myself that I love a muted palette and I love a plain backdrop. I think perhaps because of where the house is, every window we look through, we've got beautiful views and greenery. And it just felt like everything was competing all the time. There was actually William Morris in the hallway, which is a really dark room. And this was about 2 years before William Morris designs had this massive current reinvention. So I stripped it all up because it was too dark and it made the space seem too dark. And now everyone's got it up again. But it is interesting, I think, when you walk into a space. I certainly, when I walked into the house, we viewed it, the whole house filled me with joy. But then when we put ourselves in that house, with our belongings, that joy wasn't there in terms of the actual aesthetics. It made me feel quite uncomfortable for such a long time until I'd stripped out every last piece of wallpaper, and I'm on the last room now where I'm stripping the wallpaper off and I just can't wait to get back to a blank canvas. I found it so strange because I like brightness, I like colours, I like pattern, but in this house I've just gone, no, I've just not enjoyed it. And I don't know what that's about at all.
That's really interesting. And I do think we intuitively know what sparks joy for us. Mm. I mean, you mentioned one really key thing there, which was the connection with nature. So having a view, particularly of nature, you know, not another building slapped right outside your window. But if you're lucky enough to have a sea view like I do here, or you're in the countryside, that connection with nature, we know, is proven to calm us down and to help us feel more relaxed and more balanced and more harmonious. It's why greens work really well in interiors as well. Even there's evidence of, if you have images, so pictures of scenery and landscapes, they can also be, you know, the best thing is to get out in nature, right? That's the thing that's going to be best for you. But if you can't do that, then seeing nature or having nature or green things around you can be really great. So you've intuitively hooked into what works for you. And that'll be different for everyone. So some people are maximalists and love pattern and full-on colour, and they find that brings them joy, whereas other people need to be more muted. So you're saying you need a more muted palette. Yeah. And what you might find is, once you've stripped all the wallpaper, and whether you paint the whole house white or whether you just use very muted colors, over time as you settle into the space, you might find brighter, it's quite an overused word, but pops of color coming back in. And we shift and change, you know, as we get older, our eyesight diminishes. And so we tend to lean more towards brighter colors.
I had not made that connection at all. That's really interesting.
If we want to have some kind of contrast or visual interest, then we need to go for, and that doesn't mean going for bright oranges and purples and yellows, but it means that your off-white colours or your neutrals might just get slightly stronger to give you the contrast you need, because yeah, your eyes are deteriorating and we just, and our vision becomes slightly more yellow as well. So how we see colour actually changes. So I know people spend an awful lot of time finding the right white, but actually over time you'll see things with a much more yellow sort of tint to them anyway, so that can change how we see colour. Yeah,
that is so interesting. I mean, with the kitchen, we actually went for dark blue kitchen cupboards and stuff, which is a colour I never would have had in any other house. And then the living room, we've ended up repainting in a very kind of muted green. But that's the room that you sit in there and you feel like you're in the garden. It's such a beautiful space. So yeah, I think I've probably, without the science behind it, I've probably just kind of naturally gone, that's going to work well there.
Yeah. And most people do know intuitively what will work for them using green. That's a trick an interior designer would use, is connecting the outside with the inside, expanding that space. But I think we just get really scared of what to do in interiors. And that's where interior designers can help, in that they can corral all of those ideas. I mean, the internet is kind of, you know, a blessing and a curse. You can have a Pinterest board and Google a million ideas, and that can just leave you feeling really overwhelmed. Or, you know, you can be very influenced by trends and what's going on and feel like, oh, I should do that. And actually, it is about finding what sparks joy for you, which is very individual. And then, of course, you have to layer on. You've got three humans in your house. Yes. You know, what sparks joy for each of them, and does it match? And how do you, you know, that's where an interior designer can help you build a space and create a space that works for people who have very, you know, you might have somebody who loves bright colors and somebody who's more muted. How do you make an overall cohesive scheme that's going to work for everyone?
It's really interesting. As a social psychologist, the whole area of what we call nature connectedness is huge. You know, there's so much research going into not just how we connect with nature and how that, you know, mediates our well-being and our, you know, how we sense joy and our health benefits, but also nighttime connectedness. So night skies, there's a wonderful psychologist who works at the University of Derby, Chris Barnes, and he looks at the night sky and our connectedness to that as well. And then over the weekend, I'd been to Northumberland with the boys in the camper van, and I was so excited to go out for a coastal run. And I went out for the coastal run, and I was thinking, why is it that, you know, being out for a run in a different space and place, it just feels so calming? And you'll love this. There's been some research done, and there are a couple of researchers who've called this soft fascination. And they say that this doing activity, engaging your whole body in the outside world and in nature, is a soft fascination. Because in contrast to, I suppose, a city or a town where we're pulled, our attention's pulled by signs. I mean, I love the idea that, you know, when we go, and this is like kind of social geography and human geography, but when you go into a town, you have all of these place making and meaning making and geographic markers. You know where you are, what the instructions are. There's lots of things telling us what we can and we can't do by signage and by street furniture, you know, blocks things and enables things. Yet when we're in nature, we're just there and waiting for our attention to be pulled very gently. And they're calling this soft fascination out. I was really struck by that idea, and I thought, gosh, I think that's what it is that I enjoy being out in nature so much, is that I'm not feeling that I'm being assaulted by all these noises and instructions.
I love that. And that must be even more important now that we're on our screens the whole time, because it's all there's just so much being thrown at us. And you're right, when you're in a built-up space, yeah, the signage is really quite like navigating that. And we probably just take, you know, when you're walking down a high street, take it for granted that there's going to be loads of signage all over the place. But how many times have you also been, and this comes into good design as well, how many times have you been somewhere where you can't find the toilets or something, like in a pub or a restaurant, and they're signed, but there's so much signage and there's so much going on that actually, even if the sign's right in front of you, you don't see it, because you're, or how often do people go through a door and push instead of pull, even though it says it, because you're just so overwhelmed with everything else that's going on. Your senses are, I really love that soft fascination. It makes me want to go out for a run.
You should do, Lisa. And the other thing that I was thinking of there when you say you can't see the wood for the trees, if you like, is for me, it's in supermarkets, and it doesn't matter how many signs they have saying the biscuits are in this aisle or the toiletries in this. I can never find what I want because I'm not somebody who likes to go into a supermarket and browse up and down the aisles. I want to get in there, get what I want and come back out again.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And so what? Tell me more about the nighttime thing. Is that to do with the soft fascination as well, the night sky?
Different again, and again, the social scientists are quite interested in the impact of kind of light pollution on our nighttime skies, and then the downscale impact, I suppose, or downstream impact on our well-being. So this idea that if we don't step into the outside in the darkness, and that we're not at one with dark, then we've lost something. And I think there's this idea that, I suppose, over the last couple of centuries and stuff, you know, people probably had closer relationships with darkness. If you think about, I'm just thinking of different countries where they have shorter light hours. So there are some countries where there are longer darker hours, aren't there, for whole months of the year.
Yeah.
And their whole kind of community and socialness is built up around warmth and darkness and safety, and darkness being a comfort thing. And you look in modern society, darkness can be posited as a bit of a, you know, a scary place, a dangerous place. From a feminist perspective, you would say women are potentially discouraged from being out in dark and in darkness. And yet there are lots of benefits from being connected with the night sky, that awe and wonder of staring at the sky, for example. I went to this talk, it was last year at our annual psychology conference in the Midlands, and just listening to Chris talk about it in that way, it made me realise just how responsible we are for producing light and pollution, you know, lights in our gardens, that kind of thing, but also that impact that it might be having on us and our socialness. Yeah.
That's really interesting. I love that. I hadn't heard any of that. And within interiors, we do a lot of, we're all about the light generally. Interior designers are always trying to maximize light in spaces and, you know, making sure that colors render the way that they should by having good light. But usually using soft lighting and layered lighting in the evening, you know, not having the big overhead light and moving away from, you know, that scattergun of LEDs that you find in lots of houses where there's just so many LEDs and we're just in full brightness. You'll find most interior designers, you know, want you to have wall lamps and table lamps and softer yellow lighting. So it's rated in different degrees of Kelvin, and they'll want it to be like on the warmer end rather than, which is near a sort of 2700 Kelvin, rather than up near like natural daylight, which is 5000, you know, plus, which is really bright. And of course, that's the impact on your circadian rhythms. But yeah. I've never really thought about then stepping outside, you know, that connection. So we often connect gardens to interiors and we're thinking in the daytime,
yeah,
and not necessarily at night. I love that.
I think something just popped into my mind is a memory I've got as a child when my bedroom in my childhood home used to look out onto the street, and there was a lamp outside the street, and one of my favorite things to do was to look at that lamp when it was on in the dark, because it was an orangey light, a yellowy light, and especially in the winter it'd be watching to see if there was any snow, because it was the only way you could tell if it was snowing.
Yes, as it crossed the path, the beam of light.
It's such a vivid memory that I've got. One of the things then with the night sky and lightness is obviously a lot of modern lights outside are now not those soft warming hues. They're those brighter lights because, you know, they're safer and they light up a street more. So it is interesting, and it's interesting what you say about the rhythms and how it affects our sleep quality, and that all feeds into then how we experience the world and what joy we get from it.
Absolutely. And it does also make me a little bit sad, because you're right, I definitely don't venture out in the same way at night as I do in the day. And I'm actually fortunate to live on a street which has no street lighting. It's like a private road. So at night, it's really beautiful and it's quite dark. There's not too much light pollution. And particularly because we have a view of the sea, if there's a really nice big fat full moon, the way the light bounces off the bay, the water is just absolutely stunning. And you can see the lights, as in, you know, house lights and road lights around the bay. So we've got that really magical view that we have. But I don't often, if I go to my book club or something like that and I'm walking home, I am anxious walking. I can't say that I've ever stopped and just looked up at the sky until I get home, because I'm anxious about, is there anybody around? There's no lights on the street. And at nighttime, when you're walking home on your own, you're thinking, oh, I wish we had street lighting. I feel really unsafe. You know, it's that female thing. Whereas if I'm with my husband or with a group of friends, then I feel much more relaxed and we're much more likely to look up and go, oh, look at the moon. Isn't that amazing? And of course, everybody's been out this year because it's a great year for the Northern Lights, isn't it? Although
it's been amazing.
I haven't seen them so far. I'm so annoyed.
Are you, I'm guessing you're quite far south, aren't you? So you on the coast.
We're right on the coast, yeah.
So I'm in the Midlands, and this is the first time in my adult life I've ever seen the Northern Lights. And I know North Midlands, like top of the Peak District, you can see them every other year or so. You can usually see something. But you have to be out there on top of a hill and with a really good camera. But we saw stuff, and it was amazing. You couldn't see it with the naked eye. You had to take photos to be able to catch. But it was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it's quite frustrating. It's on my bucket list. And at the minute, that involves an expensive trip to somewhere Nordic to go and see them. And I was like, if they could just appear in this country, that would save me a flight and accommodation.
Just travel up to the Midlands.
Yeah.
Destination. There is something really interesting there, though, isn't there? I think I just had Ange Friesen, who you know, on the podcast. And she said to me what kind of came through to her when I was talking about joy was really what stops joy, the barriers to joy. And that reflection that you've made there around, you know, actually, I'm worried, I'm looking at other things rather than looking at the night sky. It's that kind of what stops us from experiencing joy in those ways. I might ask you more of a personal question then around, you know, where does joy show up personally for you? And just for some context, and if you're comfortable to talk about it, I know that you've had one of the reasons you transitioned into the career you're in was health reasons.
Yeah.
I know that about you. And I'm just wondering how that joy journey has kind of unfolded over the last decade, really.
It's really interesting. And no, I don't mind talking about it at all. So health caused me to pivot from my first career, which was a corporate career and 10 years at Microsoft, into interior design. And then the last 5 years, I've then switched again into sort of mentoring and coaching and my online membership and helping other interior designers. So there's kind of two sides to it. There's the business side and the life side, and I guess they're quite meshed. But on the business side, if you look at typically, I think what you would see in the patriarchal world that we live in, and do more, earn more equals success, that I'm less successful. But what I have learned is that I've switched my values around. And actually, with that health story and being very critically ill, and I've had some ongoing health issues, success, and I equate that now to joy, is actually very different. So I earn tons less, but I actually get to spend time in the garden. I actually get time to spend doing things which I love. So that comes both into the business in terms of really having now, I was very good at what I did before when I worked at Microsoft. I was really successful, you know, the hard work, the earning loads of money, but it didn't bring me that much joy. Whereas what I do now in helping other people, but also when I was doing the interior design and the creativity, that side of things, that joy is, it's immeasurable. The difference is kind of, you know, black and white between that and between now. And it's been a sense of coming or getting to grips with the fact that I earn less money, and how does that How do I perceive that? And how do other people perceive that? That's quite a difficult journey to go on. But alongside that, I've recognized that I just need to slow down, that, you know, your body gives you signals and tells you when it needs to take a break. I've experienced burnout. I've worked too hard before. That's what caused the health issues. And now with slowing down, it's allowed me to find more joy in what I do. So yes, with the work, in being curious, in trying new things, in having a slower, calm approach, you don't miss the joy moments. You have a chance to, whereas before when I was work really hard, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, on to the next thing. You're almost moving so fast that you miss those opportunities, those sparks that come along, those connections, collaborations, or just giving stuff time to pan out. And I don't like to use the word failure because I think everything's a learning opportunity, but sometimes things don't work out right the way that you thought they would. And whereas before I might be working so fast and so hard that I'd take that as a hit and I'd just move on to the next thing, now I'm, oh, that's interesting. Why didn't that work? And, oh, but actually, that person said that thing about it. And actually, maybe there's some joy there. Maybe there's some collaboration. Maybe there's a different opportunity. So that comes into it.
I think one of the things, I always loved about you, and I think it must have been about 4 years ago, we did an Instagram live on the best decision that people had ever made. And in yours, we talked about this, how I'd noticed that you're such a counterfactual thinker, and the way that you take something and you turn it around and around and around. Well, what if this happens, or why did that happen? And but also you think about the worst case scenarios, but not in a necessarily negative way. I just love the way that you were able to pick something up and almost squeeze every little possibility out of it. I think you're very unique in the way that you do it, and I don't think you'd realize that about yourself.
Oh, and that's reminded me again, I've totally forgotten we'd had that conversation. Yeah, I think you just, it's really lovely to have you say that though, thank you. And I like to just look at things from different angles, and I do analyze stuff and think of, I am a bit of an overthinker. That's an underlying kind of worry, wart, anxiety thing, which I work really hard at. But I also love being more curious. And on a personal side, with the health issues, and I've had unfortunately some more recent health issues just lately, and that has caused me to slow down again. But as part of that, I've also taken up pottery and I've taken up art, and I'm finding ways, not just through the work that I do to connect more, but through everyday life to connect more. So my pottery class, which I go to on a Saturday morning, is down in the town where I live, only, you know, 1.5 kilometers, you know, just over a mile, and I could drive down there, but I always walk unless it's absolutely lashing it down with rain. I get myself organized and I walk, one, because I'm outside in nature, but because of the sort of town it is, a little seaside town, I always bump into people, and I find such joy in connecting with people. So this Saturday, I was walking downhill into town to go to the pottery, and I met a couple who were walking, obviously quite an old little dog, and he was really struggling, and they'd had to stop, and they were in the shade, and they were sort of cajoling him, come on, you can do it, this little dog. And I stopped and chatted to them and just said, oh, is he having a hard time? And they're like, we don't know whether he's struggling or whether he's just a little bit lazy. And it was just really lovely to have that moment of human connection. You know, when you work at home the whole time and you're quite engrossed in work life, how many of us get to chat over the fence to our neighbours or actually be in our wider community?
Yeah.
And I find real joy in just connecting with other human beings. Just that 5-minute conversation, walking down the hill. And I know every time I walk down, I bump into people or I see things or I can have conversations with people who are working in their gardens. And for me, that's really joyful. And doing the pottery and the art in and of themselves are really creative and spark joy. But I'm also connecting with more people through those classes as well, and sort of broadening that connection I find really joyful. It's all that slowing down, you know, having health scares slowed me down. And every time I slow down, I find more joy in life. And honestly, it's the biggest message I have for people is around, it sounds so cliche, but trying to find those moments of joy in their everyday. But I also think we can translate that into our business as well. And it's something that I really try and do through my mentoring, through my coaching. So many of us are, if I just do that course, if I do just do that workshop, if I learn another thing, if I work, if I'm busy, that's going to mean that I'm successful. And actually, most interior designers I work with already know everything that they need to know, maybe just need a few tweaks to reach a business which is calmer and more sustainable and isn't going to lead them to burnout. It's about looking at what you're already doing, looking at the data in your business and figuring out what's working and what's not, so that you're spending your time doing the few simple things that make a difference. And then outside of that, you have more time for joy. That kind of is where I'm headed at the minute.
It's a recipe, isn't it? I feel like there's a recipe for life. And I can see how your brand of counterfactual thinking works really well as a mentor there. I think I've said this a few times. I wish I was an interior designer because I'd love to be in your membership. But a couple of things that have come to mind as you were talking there, you mentioned the word broaden, and you know, it's no surprise there's and one of the kind of core motivational theories is called broaden and build, you know, in order to enhance well-being and to be motivated, we have to broaden and build on those things in our life that bring us joy. And it's interesting, I was watching a clip on, I think it was through Instagram, somebody had posted a snippet from an interview with a person called Freya India. She was talking about how Gen Z don't have these moments of community. They don't have these moments of offline connection in the way of wandering down the street and saying hi to a neighbour. She talks about, we've learned to flirt through apps. We've learned to do this online. We've learned to do that online. And likewise, we were in Northumberland at the weekend, and my husband's very busy at work, and I've just stepped back from contract work for a while, and I'm going into a softer space with my business for a while, which I'm really looking forward to. And already I noticed the difference in our energy levels as we approach this weekend. I'm like kind of slowing down and noticing the little things, and you know, having lots of little chats with people, and you know, you see yourself start to kind of go, oh, I can relax into this and I can just spend time here because I'm not waiting to go to the next place that I feel that I need to rush to or get to. And I was noticing a little bit of that difference. But to what Freya was saying about Generation Z, I suppose, not having that community, I wonder how much of that is actually true, because I know online communities, when they're done well, create so much positive well-being. And we've both experienced this, I think, through communities in the past, and one in particular. And then you create one as well. So I do think sometimes tech can be a bit of a, oh, it's a bad thing and we need to spend more time offline. But actually, I think if it's balanced with spending time in nature and spending time face to face with people, it's such a positive thing as well. I wondered what your views on that are.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the biggest thing for me around community probably leads into kind of a lot of your work around imposter syndrome. An imposter, the word we can't say, phenomenon, in that a lot of our online world is that very glossy, polished, look at me, I'm flying and I'm doing really well. And I know for interior designers that, you know, look at this amazing client I've landed, and they're showing pictures of the site visit where all the trades are where they need to be, doing what they need to be doing, and the project's just going smoothly. And they've just landed like a magazine feature. Cut to real life and the trades don't pitch up when, you know, they say they will, or one of them, you know, it's still quite a masculine environment and you're having a really hard time establishing your authority as part of a project or on site, or you're struggling to find new clients, get into community, and certainly the community that I've built. And it's about stripping back those layers. Yes, of course, we celebrate when somebody gets a magazine feature or completes an amazing project, and we share pictures in there of how it's going. But we're also there to talk about having a hard day and the fact that working the way that we work and working at home can be lonely, and we're not sure how to price, and we have priced and now we're really nervous about it, and we're being ghosted by a client, and all of that sort of thing gets discussed. And in community, it doesn't necessarily take away imposter syndrome. I think we always experience that, but it gives you the skills to cope with it and go, it's not just me. Plus, you get support from people going, you can do it, and don't worry, ignore your inner critic. You're doing really well, and that's normal, and I've had that before, and here's how I dealt with it. And if you're scared of doing stuff, you get accountability, which just helps you to keep on track and not lose that focus. So, yeah, I think being online can be negative, but there are real positives. If you find, and I think it's about finding the right place for you, and that will be different for different people.
Yeah.
But a truly supportive space where you can share the negative, but also you can share the wins. You know, they always say, don't they, like a true friend is somebody who's also really happy to hear the good news, not just commiserate with the bad news. And both, I think, are welcome.
Yeah, there was actually research on that. And the popular phrase is, you'll always remember who was there for you during the bad times, through the struggles. And there was a group of researchers who looked at a group of cancer patients and their families. I think it's women who were going through breast cancer treatment. Mm. And they were saying, actually, it wasn't necessarily who was there to support them through the difficult news and the difficult times. It was who was there with them supporting the joyful moments and the positive stuff. So they remembered more the people who they were able to share their small successes with. And that goes a little bit counterfactual, counter obvious to what we think it would be. But it's so true. I think we do remember who supports us, and we do remember who is around. And a lot of the, I mean, I did my research very specifically on online communities and looking at, does imposter phenomenon show up? How does it show up? And what we know is that in an online community, if it's got all of the right ingredients, it reduces feelings of imposterism, because that, I called it, there's no comparison. You don't compare yourself against an ideal. You compare yourself against reality. And we were talking just earlier about, you know, the reality is that not every day is great, but that's okay. So I think there's a lot in there, isn't there, about how I always say online is not different to offline. It's an extension of. And I think in the same way that an interior designer might layer a room with different types of lighting, I think we need different types of community and different types of interaction, don't we, to have that richness in our life.
Absolutely. I think that's so true. And I do love that. Yes, it's really important to have space, whether it's, you know, friends or whether it is in business, to be real and to say, I'm struggling with this, and not feel like you have to pretend that everything's perfect. That's really important. But having a space that's safe enough to actually say, I just landed this amazing client, is, there's kind of two parts to it. One is that the in my case, the interior designer needs to feel safe that they can say, oh my God, I've just got this amazing client. This project has come in and I'm so thrilled, and not feel like they're bragging and that there's no place for it. But equally, have a kind of soft landing space for the designers in that group who, yes, are supportive, but also will have a moment of, why is it happening for her and not for me? And then supporting that. So that's something I'm always really mindful of as well, is one, a space where people can celebrate those wins, but also a space to catch the people who I can see are struggling and aren't quite at the same stage, because we're all at different stages and we all go through peaks and troughs. And so it's helping those other designers as well feel the feels. Yeah, feel, oh God, it feels a bit unfair. And yet they're vocalizing how supportive they are, and they genuinely are, but then also providing space for, like, how do we get you there? How can we use that as an aspiration, and what could you do in your business which is going to help you on that track and follow along? Like, we're all lifting each other up, right?
So at the heart of social psychology, this idea of social comparison, it's always about that upward and downward comparison. What are they doing? How do I get a bit of that? Or, you know, why am I here? I thought I was exactly the same as them. And we do a lot of this kind of comparison of performance and perspectives and where we're at. Interestingly, I was reading, there was a psychologist who did some research, and about the impact that that kind of culture has on children, where children know what their performance is compared to peers. If I think back to when I was like 5 or 6, I didn't know if I was better or worse than somebody else. And my little one came back from school and it had a week of tests, which I wasn't aware of as a parent. And he now knows where he is in that class. And I thought, he's 9. Does he need to know that now? It's interesting, isn't it? There are times where I think it's helpful for us to know that. But what this professor was saying was, when you do it, you have to make sure that the environment is right. So you can't have a performance culture, which actually a lot of online spaces and communities are about increasing your performance, your sales, your business, da, da, da. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's very feminist to say I will be proud and I will brag because I can. Offset of that is, are we in a very psychologically supportive environment? It sounds like you do that effortlessly. You know, you're keeping one eye out and you're going, is it safe? You know, is there balance here?
I hope so, because I think quite often when I work with interior designers, they will mention another designer that they've seen, and they will mention about, why aren't I getting, you know, I'm doing these jobs and I'm maybe doing 1 or 2 rooms and I want to be doing a full house renovation. I see that designer over there and I want to be doing that. And the questions that I will ask are not necessarily, okay, how do we get from here to there? But actually, are you building a business intentionally? Do you know what you're actually building and what that actually means? So if you do that massive 6-bedroom house, you will not sleep for the next, you know, 18 months, potentially. Like, it's a high demanding client. It's full on. And I thought you'd said to me that you actually wanted to take the summer off and spend more time with your kids. And the reason that you set up your interior design business is you wanted flexibility. That means that you might need to work in a different way. So it's almost like this myth we're sold again of this whole being busier and having the bigger jobs and the more high profile stuff is what success looks like. But what are you building your business intentionally? It comes back to that. And what is it that you actually wanted to achieve? And if you didn't want to build particularly big, if you don't want to employ people, if you are at least, I mean, of course, the financials come into it. You need to be a profitable business and making enough money doing what you're doing. But sometimes that kind of grass is always greener isn't necessarily going to work for you. That there are things that come with getting into a magazine or doing the bigger projects. Or maybe it's just not the right time for your business. Maybe once the kids are older, you'll have that space to take on bigger projects. I think it's important, to be careful what we wish for sometimes.
So much of what you're saying is ringing true for me at the moment as I navigate this transition again with my career and, you know, stepping back into the PhD and doing the research I want to do with the businesses I work with. I might not make as much money this next year, but there's a cost actually to me with being a very busy working parent, as there is for my husband. And I think we're both appreciate the softness of one of us not going at 100% or 100 miles an hour all of the time.
I loved what you said about that and how your husband and you arrived in different spaces.
Yeah.
And I think you can feel that. When I recently went on holiday with my husband, he works incredibly hard and it just barely seems to come up for air, whereas because of health, but I'm taking a lot of softer approach. When we arrived on holiday, you know, his wind down time and ability to, he's pretty good at it. He's South African, so they are pretty laid back. But I could notice the difference coming into it and then how relaxed he was by the end of it. Whereas I'm pretty much was there already. Yes, I relaxed a bit more, but his was quite marked in terms of of yeah, that journey. It's interesting.
It's really curious what we notice. And then as I've walked out to the camper van this morning to do this call, he's at the table and he's on a phone call with his entire team. They have like this morning call on a Monday. And I just took a moment, sat there eating my breakfast, listening to the joy in his voice, because he's really enjoying telling people about his trip to Northumberland. And they were learning how to fly broomsticks at Alnwick Castle. And he was like replaying that whole thing. And I know that he didn't find it necessarily as easy to relax as I did. But now I can hear the benefit of the weekend away. This transference of joy is a real thing. If we sit and listen to other people's joy, we get the benefit from that as well. His colleagues were talking about they've been paddleboarding and doing this and doing the other. And I thought, what a lovely way to start the week, actually, to just have a good old chat with your friends.
Yeah, that's really uplifting. I love that.
Lisa, it's been such a pleasure to chat to you. I knew it would be.
Thank you so much for having me. It has been a joy.
How do people get in touch with you?
I am interiordesigninsiders.com. You can find more about coaching, consultancy, membership. I'm the same on Instagram, on @interiordesigninsiders. Reach out if there's anybody out there who needs that support. I'm here for that.
That's it for today. If you've enjoyed the episode, please like and subscribe.